Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Willow, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. I met Jeff. I want to welcome to you the show, Jeff Paris, a great guitarist, multi-instrumentalist, producer. He's done it all, and a pretty famous songwriter. If you're a big fan of Mr. Big, they covered one of his tunes, Lucky This Time, and he also wrote a song for that was used by Lita Ford, Gotta Let Go, just some of the stuff that he's done. But he's done a lot of stuff, and we're going to talk about some of the people that he's worked with. And we got a good roster of clips from some of his solo albums that span many years and very cool tones, great guitar player. But I want to thank Louis Castro, a very good friend of mine, who introduced me. I met them over at Mel's Diner. They came in and we chatted, and this show is a result of that. So I wanted to thank Louis. Jeff, it's really great to have you on the show. Welcome.
What an accident! we were over at the Blues Emporium there in our area, the Maui Sugar Mill. Nice shout out to God, like Zach, who we love, and then we just decided to go to Mel's, and
we were there.
I don't think I was that inebriated at the time, but I totally forgot after we talked about doing the show that I was going to do it, and the rest is history. So.
Well, you have a pretty varied career. Let's talk a little bit, and we'll get into some of the clips in a minute. Let's talk a little bit about your background, your influences, and how you came to be where you are now. Because a lot of stuff, you do a lot of keyboards right now. You've been gigging a lot doing keyboards. But you're one of the classic examples of a master of a lot of different things and wearing different hats so that you can be versatile in the studio. And I forgot who had the quote. He just said, like, you're just an invaluable tool or something to use in the studio.
Oh, the Keb Moe. Keb Moe. He's sort of a household name, isn't he? It's strange.
I know.
He's really the sweetest guy. We've known each other for years. He called me the... You blocked
senior moment.
Yeah,
I mean, it's contagious.
I'm a junior senior, but he called me the Swiss Army knife.
That's it.
Yeah, he said the Swiss Army knife. He said we need use our Swiss Army knife. You know, but anyway, lots of instrumental switching.
Yeah, very cool. But tell me about your early. Music career. What were your influences? Where you studied all of that?
It's one of the most interesting things was my mother before she passed away told me a little tidbit on top of everything else. So my parents loved music. And my dad was the nephew by marriage of Con Conrad, who wrote the Continental, and that's his most famous song, which you, if you don't know the Continental, it was sung by Fred Astaire or something like that, mm-hmm. in one of those movies.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, no,
the Continental. Yeah. Dun. You know, nobody's done a Texas Shuffle on that. It'd be probably pretty good, but. Con was massively successful, and you know it's been 100 years, so his success has you know sort of dropped off the radar, but and my dad played trumpet, and it came back to affect me in a negative way because the Depression affected everybody's feeling about the economics of being a musician. So my dad ended up being a dentist. Mm. But anyway, they sang all the time when I was a little kid. They sang all the time, and it was standards. And I sang at two, in tune.
Oh, wow.
And I have a tape. I wish I have to bake it, you know, because it'll just fall apart from, you know. I was born in 1951, so there... I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
So I had that foundation. But when I grew up and I embraced music on my own terms, we didn't go with our parents' music. So I repudiated it. And my parents used to ask me, can't you sing some of those old songs you used to sing? And I said, that's your music. Years later now, it came back like a time bomb, and I have dropped everything to explore 40s jazz, post 40s swing, bop, mm-hmm. Because I bounce between keyboards and guitar. Finally, technically, I spent more time getting training on piano. I'm a street player when it comes to guitar, but I asked my mom why I was having this sudden renaissance of realization about these songs that, you know, frankly, everybody thinks of it as sound lounge music, but it's you know, Miles Davis and it's, Jerome Kern and, you know, all these fantastic writers that basically wrote the standards that even blowing guys like Sonny Rollins and Miles Davis play, right?
Mm-hmm.
They changed the tunes and made them hip, like a lot of people do even now, right?
Mm-hmm.
She goes, oh, well, you know, when we brought you home from the hospital, you know, the guy upstairs was Jimmy Van Heusen, and he was staying up to 5 a.m. playing that damn piano, and you could never sleep. I went, this is the guy that wrote But Beautiful, and I've Got the World on a String, and, you know, so I'm 2 years old, or I'm literally newborn, and I'm listening to this. Heavy guy. Yeah. And then she said, and then Sinatra would come over, and they'd stay up all night long, and you never could. I went, oh, my God, osmosis. Then when I decided I wanted to play, well, look, it was first the folk revolution of the late 50s, early 60s. So it was Peter, Paul, and Mary, Pete Seeger. We all took folk guitar lessons. So there was no sweeping. There was no Berkeley. There was no scales. There was no Eddie Van Halen tapping. It was just put your fingers on there and play. Old school. And the guitar was an accompanist instrument. So you would learn songs. So I went to folk class, and I learned a million folk songs. Then the Beatles hit, and that's the next nodal point in, you know, everybody's history. We rejected Elvis. If you were born in the early 50s, you know, you had to be in your late teens or or early 20s, mm-hmm. in the 50s, in the middle 50s, to comprehend the Sam Phillips and all that stuff that was going on. Right?
Yeah. No, correct. Yeah.
Because if you're 4 years old, you're poised for post Elvis, and that's exactly what happened. So Beatles hit because we went from folk to British invasion without the stop of roots rock, rockabilly, none of that. And then Beatles the whole arc of the Beatles, it was really the Beatles and Beatles 1, Beatles 2, Beatles 3, because they changed. Yeah. That's where the Spinal Tap joke and the montage.
You weren't influenced by the Beach Boys, the Ventures?
Oh, yeah. Because
that was a big part after Elvis.
Yeah, surf music. Yeah, it was surf music. Top 40 AM. And songs, because my introduction into playing was learning the words, singing, and comping on guitar.
Right.
You know, and we're talking about, you know, this. Okay, this is the first thing. Hush, little. Of course, it was, hush, little baby. Don't stop, boy. Mama's going to feel good. And as I, this old man, he played one. He played knick-knack on my thumb on knick-knack. Right?
Right.
Look who used that. He did it too. Steve Tyler. Knick-knack, back. Right?
Yeah.
That's where he learned it. We all went through the folk, and that material is, you know, the genesis of Bob Dylan. So it really was a great foundation. And then, you know,
yeah, the early Beatles stage one,
right? And then, you know, and then the rest of the, it wasn't too long after the Beatles that you got into the second wave of 60s rock, which was, for me, probably... Oh, the blues revolution. This happened at the same time. Towards the end of the folk thing, it was like Mance Lipscomb and T-Bone Walker. So blues started... It was really an amazing thing to go from folk to blues to rock. So you got everything in the right...
Well, that's interesting because you had you had blues before you got to the rock. So
right. So
that's interesting because that's
because historically, exactly.
And a lot of the other groups from England, that's right. How they did it.
Right. We all resonated with the same. But I was younger, you know, so I came to Chicago blues a little bit later.
Now, you were in L.A. during all of this as a child?
Yeah, I was born in St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica.
Oh, okay. So you were here.
Yeah.
That's an interesting time, too, for L.A.,
which year are you talking about?
Well, late 50s, early 60s. There was, because you were musically around here, there was a lot of stuff that was going on of the, well, you had the...
Right, but the radio was the real contact point,
right.
You know, and...
And back then it was more independent. It wasn't a, you know, it's not a big one corporation that owns all of them. Back then there were a lot more DJs that were playing what they wanted.
It was I hate to say it, but that movie that Burt Bacharach and Elvis Costello did the music for is really a great movie for this sort of arc of Brill Building. But anyway, so what happened is blues and Mike Bloomfield and Paul Butterfield, mm-hmm. and all that stuff was happening right at the same time that the Beatles gave way to the Doors. And those of us who were listening to the radio, we were moving into psychedelia when the blues explosion happened. And it didn't have to be, because I mean, even, you know, leave your hands off. I mean, it's like, you know. But the thing is there was this guy named Rick Fleischman who was just gifted, a fantastic guy who ended up in the studios like Barney Kessel in the film studios in his later life. And he was about a year older than all of us, maybe a year and a half, but he looked like he was 50 years older than us because he was one of these old souls. He, even at 17 or 16, he looked like he was, you know, 45. And great looking guy. And he gave guitar lessons for $5. So right around the time I was starting to, you know, get into electric, and I had a couple of little bands I'd started. We were learning, you know, hey, little girl, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, I saw her walking on down the line. You know,
I remember that.
Hanky-panky, you know.
Dirty Water, Standells.
Right. I even had a Standell amp.
My
first
those.
Amp. And an SG Junior, which had binding on it, and it's freaking worth $90,000 now. I told.
And you sold it
for
it.
A Strat. I sold it for a Telecaster. But anyway, Rick, I wanted to, you know, I was really into blues and I was starting to play harmonica, you know, because I heard Paul Butterfield. So my first lesson, Rick says, what are you listening to? I go, well, that new band, The Doors, you know, they hear you like, your lost little girl. I love that song. And it was on the radio, even though it was like, you know, their other songs were, you know, 20th Century Fox and so forth. I loved your lost little girl and that dark thing. But he goes, The Doors. I go, this is insight into me. I'm just like a freaking guy who wants to like be part of the, you know, I'm like, well, what should I be listening to, Rick? He goes, he takes a piece of music paper, he writes down, which was really hip. He took a piece of script paper, you know, staff paper. He writes, live at the Regal, B.B. King, and blues is king, B.B. King. He goes, go get those. And I go, okay. Okay, so, you know, now what? He goes, lesson's over. I go, fee goes $5. I go, wait, we didn't even play. He goes, no point in playing till you listen to the records. So I buy the records, and I buy both records, and I come home, and I put in Live at the Regal, and there was, what's that movie where the guy's face just, I mean, I think it's a dream or something like that. Oh, yeah, it's Linda Hamilton in The Terminator, where she's having a dream, and the bomb goes off, and then, you know, that is the metaphor for what happened when I heard Live at the Regal. Ladies and gentlemen, let's have a nice warm round of applause for the king of the blues, Mr. B.B. King. You know? And I listened to the whole thing, and then the side ended. I rushed it. And then I listened to it again. And then I started shedding, and I went back to Rick, and I just, you know, I never did listen to the other record, the studio record. It was a wimpy record compared to this. This is it. And there's a couple of things about that record that really are important. It's not just BB and his playing. It's his talking. It's his personality. And the stories that the songs, it's not just, it's to tell you the truth, this is true of gospel, because gospel music is the genesis of all this stuff, and it's about the story. And then what makes the playing so great is you know what the story is. So you're not just, oh, well, you take your own. No, it's about, you know, a sweet little angel. I love the way she spreads her wings, you know? Mm-hmm. With smart chords. Right. The band is there. I'm kind of sweet little angel.
Now, at that time, what, did you have an electric guitar or you just had an acoustic guitar?
I think I had the electric. Yeah, I had the electric because my parents, God bless them, they went along, you know. But anyway, so anyway, the other thing about that record is it's the perfect gig. It's the best gig you could ever have. He goes like, you know, woo! You know, everything he does, he's got, you know, and they're not hard licks to play. Yeah, so what's the deal?
It's just the feel.
It's
the hands.
it's all of the above. It's magical, and you could never, and that's probably every one of his gigs was like that, but you'd be lucky if you have one. I've been with a lot of guys now, and the audiences, I've never seen an audience go as crazy as they did at the Regal Theater for B.B. King. So that's it. That's awful. You know, it's like you're going, okay, that's an ideal gig. You can never reach. You can maybe have some.
You know. Yeah.
And so so the blues invasion revolution thing was John Mayall, you know, the American guys, and you know, sorry out there, I can't remember every single one, but that what spoke to me. Then the next thing I heard after that, now I was my ears, and now we were starting blues bands. I was in blues bands now. I had switched. I never listened to another road. I don't think I ever played any more Doors songs after that. And then one day I'm rehearsing with my buddy, a couple of buddies at a house, and I hear, I'm a sleepy time baby, sleepy time boy, work only maybe. Now you can say that, or Clapton, it's no hands, right? I'm a sleepy time baby, I'm a sleepy time boy, I work only maybe, life is a joy, cause I'm a... Where's the music? Where's the guitar part? It's a controversial point that I got to, and I'm not the only one. Paul Williams talks about this, Jimmy Webb talks about this. When they used to write songs... I don't mean to be cross-modulating here, but
that's okay.
When they wrote songs, they would go, you know. Okay, let's get the pads out. They won't write any more music because they know it's done. Okay, what's the song? No, that's the song. People tell me, oh, I got a new song, and this will play me a chord. What's the song? What's the title of the song? The lyrics of the bones. And it's true blues, too. Although that's a great lick.
Yeah.
That's a great lick. So you have to look at yourself and say, the lick, if you go...
But a good lyric hook or a good line tells you the harmonic progression. It tells you.
Okay, so, you know, that's just boring. But if you go... I'm a sleepy time baby. Now, I did sing it, and it was interesting because, see, language and stories are interesting. But when you add that lick, so the idea that you're going to go, I don't really care about the lyrics, that's crazy. They're not even lyrics. I consider it's like there's bass drums, lyrics, background vocals. Well, wait a minute. What are you talking about? The lyrics have the groove. They have the phrasing. They have the rhythm. A drummer can get, you can recite the lyrics in rhythm, drummer will know what the groove is. You can play some stuff. He'll go like, well, which do you want? You want a shave? You know what I mean? So, but seriously, you know. You know, playing 12s on blues is a little tough.
Yeah.
Sleeping time all the time. So that was it, Clapton. Now, at the time, was I thinking, you know, it's like you just absorb that, see the lyrics and the music and the melody give you the sort of, you could say the lick accompanies the lyrics or the lyrics accompany the lick. But the point is the synergy between the two. When I heard, and then Ginger, when he comes in, boom, 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 because I'm a... Oh my God!
Yeah, but that riff is its answer, and it's, you know,
incredible.
It's part of the.
It's incredible. Yeah. It's incredible. I'm just saying that Jack Bruce and what he did. I mean, it's them. You know, it's a them thing, and so of course I ran out and bought the record, and then I heard about this. Then I heard about John Mayall, and that he would, you know, and then I went back to that, and I. You know, so that was the blues thing, and then somewhere along the line, all the rest of the stuff.
You know? Well, it's interesting. You hit you discovered the blues before you got into the more the rock stuff. The Beatles came after the blues, right? When did the blues thing happen? Early '60s for you?
There was a UCLA folk festival. Where they had T-Bone, and you would go into their different lecture rooms at UCLA, and I saw T-Bone Walker, I saw Abednego. It's the guy with This Land Is Your Land. Pete Seeger.
Yeah.
And Peter Paul and Mary. And blues guys, you know, all kinds of, you know, folk blues. Lightning Hopkins was there,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Wow.
And I think that was early 60s.
But it's interesting. You absorbed this.
The Stones reached America after I'd gotten my first Blues Foundation. So I knew where it was coming from. But the thing is it was all threading together. The folk thing, the surf thing, the blues thing, and Dylan and Hendrix and Clapton, it was all rotating and vibing off of each other. So, of course, you're going to, you know, if you're the type of person who, it's almost some kind of musician's Buddhism where, you know, the point of Buddhism, one of the features, I wouldn't say, I'm not a Buddhist, but Alan Watts, once I saw him talk about this, he goes, I always, you know, they say you should see the world as a whole, as a, like everything merged together. And he talks about, well, I couldn't make the horrible looking taxi cabs in London merge with the rest of the trees. And
yeah.
You know, but I love that. But I was able to merge every, I saw the connections, you know, and Elton, you know, and then FM radio came out. And so you were just exposed to all this stuff. But I definitely gravitated. There was a point, you know, probably the blues led me to Muscle Shoals, Memphis Soul, Philly Soul, Motown.
It definitely had to have an impact on how you perceived rock.
No,
I
just...
Even the Beatles.
It all...
Because there's blues in them, too.
Right, but, you know, so anyway, then then the whole Motown thing, everything, but especially Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, Stevie, Marvin Gaye, When I seriously zeroed in on, and you know, my particular sensibility was, I came in contact with the issue of this was African American music, and if you were going to do it, it's not like you have to sound, you know, you don't have to be, sorry for the pun, you're slavishly trying to, you know, it's, you have to be soulful. The mm-hmm. idea, finally, I zeroed in on this aspect of everything I liked had this, you know, it's soulful and it goes back to gospel. And gospel is based on the idea of your praise. And it's not about, oh, he's a great gospel singer, I love the sound of his voice. It's like, I like what he's saying. I like what he's saying. And when you listen to gospel music and listen to ad libs at the end of a kicking hymn, they don't go, whoa, you know, it's, you know, Lord, save me. It's lyric. It's the singing is serving the message. And the way the best pop music for me is the singing and the voice serve the message, whatever the song is about. Anyway, you know, I was exposed to jazz at an early age, so that was still in the mix.
Diverse.
It's a crazy story, and I'm going to stop here. And you, if you have some more questions you want to ask me,
well, one thing I want to
dominate too hard.
I'm going to play a clip from one of the early ones. This is called "I'm Better" from "Race to Paradise" is the name of the album. Interesting sound. You'll definitely, if I think it's a full-blown Marshall sound, and I'm going to play a little bit of the verse into the lead, and then I want to talk about your keyboards influencing your guitar, and go a little bit into that. But let me play this. This is one of his solo efforts, and it's interesting here. It's a pretty aggressive sound, and I think it's something to take note of. Because you can hear the influences that you're talking about. So here, this is "I'm Better." Now, that sound, that type of guitar, that screaming guitar, what you were saying about BB and the feel, I can feel that. I mean, you're playing a different riff. It's a blues riff, but it's a lot of angst and passion in those. The fingers are really working there.
First of all, you picked the song that was my flagship song when I started to put my project together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I wrote that with Michael Caruso, mm-hmm. who's a fantastic songwriter. We were just talking today. He just keeps getting better and better.
Now, let me ask you, what were you using on that?
So I'm pretty.
That's an interesting sound.
I'm pretty sure at that point I had this Kramer, and it had a massive neck. I like a lot of real estate because I had these big chords, and then I would have everybody was sort of like.
Right.
Well, maybe it was from this, right? That Hendrix-y kind of shape. Mm-hmm. So I reversed it. So instead of going... And I added a 9, which I could turn into a... So now we got... So, that riff is, and then the way I played it was, so it was that. Fret and then
very
and I had a but Lance, my producer, before I went moved on, he wanted me to go and have a and it was probably a good idea.
I don't know. I like the changes.
Well, it's, you know, you can play it by yourself.
But it's the interesting thing, and what I wanted to ask you about now, you started music primarily on keyboards. How did that affect your approach to guitar? You self-taught yourself.
You said I started music on keyboards.
You said you studied piano, right?
I started on guitar.
You did?
I had an experience at 8 when I knew, first of all, I was already sitting down and playing clusters and stuff. And I had this thing I would do on piano. And I would play the thing, you know, and I was holding lines and, you know, and doing coherent things. And my parents were just sort of not, you know, they weren't, you know. I mean, I didn't know, you know, I was like 5 and I was doing this stuff. My friends were all mad at me, you know. I'd come over to play, and then I'd go to the piano. If I saw a piano, that was it. They'd come in and say, "Mom, he's playing the piano." My friend Howard, he just hated this, you know, I said, "Hey, man, I want to come over. Let's read some comics." He goes, "Yeah, but don't play the piano." So I was zeroing in on it. And everybody said, "If it's just taking lessons." And my parents said, "No, he's not." So I don't know what that was all about. But my grandmother finally said, "You got to give him piano lessons." And the piano lessons they got me were a salesman at Penny Owsley, where they rented the piano. And the guy sucked. It's like he put a piece of music in front of me, and he just blah, 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 A, blah, blah, B, middle C, blah, 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 blah. That's all I heard. And that was it. I stopped playing. I had no interest in piano after that. I said, "If this is piano playing, I don't want to do it." And my parents were so happy because they wanted me to go out and play with my friends, play ball in the street and stuff. So, of course, about 6-8 months later, I said to a guy who was living in our house, who was going to UCLA, we hosted students. Mm-hmm. You know, they were just great guys. They were like brothers to me. And this one guy, I was saying, "Man, I want to play something. I want to play something." He goes, "Well, my dad plays guitar." And I went, "Guitar?" And I already knew for some reason that it was a harmonic instrument, so I could still have my chords, which I obviously. And that's why, otherwise, if I had the right teacher, I'd be like, way better now than I am.
I don't know that the one that turned you on to the BB King. I think that was a pivotal point.
That's right. So, look, you find your way through, and you go down your path, and, you know, I love everybody. Yeah. You know, I love my parents, and, you know, I wish they were around for me to apologize to. But my point is I, and this time, my mother stepped in, and she found me a folk guitar teacher, like I said, Irene Naftalin. And she would put the lyrics with the chords written over the tops, and, you know, I came back after the first week. Little baby, everybody's looking at me, you know, with their mouths hanging open. And everybody could kind of stumble through it. And, but the next thing I knew was like, Fall looked in the autumn mist and a land gone.
Well, Puff the Magic Dragon.
Right, right. So I sit down. Between 1 week and the next, I'd taken a firmer for 4 years. I could sit down and I could play a 90-minute set by the time I was, I don't know, like 9 or 10.
That's amazing.
But nobody, my parents didn't say, come on, let's take him down and let him, you know, let's go to Ledbetter's in Westwood. And, you know, it's like I would sit down and as soon as he put a guitar in my lap, I would play 15 tunes and then go, like I woke up from a trance. I was just immersed and involved, and I love the feeling, you know. Well, the fox went out on a chilly night, right? Go tell Aunt Rhody. I had all these, you know, songs, and they were right there with Pete Seeger. I was a little freaking little tiny Pete Seeger. So they weren't really reacting to this, but they didn't stop the guitar. And then I returned to piano when I was about 17 one day. A buddy of mine went in to the music room, and there was the piano just sitting there, and I sat down and I went, you know, with the bass line and the whole thing. And I just sat down and played. I suddenly looked at it and said, I get it. And then that was it, off to the races. From the time I found a classical teacher, very learned almost no classical, but she taught me hand position scales. I knew what I wanted to play, and I heard Leon Russell.
Yeah.
And I heard Leon Russell on Delaney and Bonnie's record, all over that record, but The Ghetto, you know, The Ghetto. Have you ever lived in a ghetto? He plays. And then ding, then ding, I'm deep. He's playing this big chord. He's playing gospel.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was it. I was in rock band, so I kept playing. But I studied piano.
Well, it's interesting because keyboard players that go to migrate to guitar look at it differently. But also the other way around. A guitar player going to keyboards looks at it differently.
Oh, it screws you up. The piano playing like crazy. I played so hard because I was trying to get guitar energy. So when I take a solo, I mean, I just killed.
Because I had a class at SC with Jack Marshall, and he said guitar players, like when you write string arrangements, he said people love when he gets hired for doing string arrangement because he phrases it like you would on a guitar, and it's a different voicing than a keyboard player when they write arrangements.
He's a guitar player?
He was, yeah. He was...
Who are we talking about?
Jack Marshall.
Okay.
He was an arranger guitarist.
But he started as a keyboard
player. His nephew was Christopher Parkeny.
Yeah, God, Chris.
So he, but anyway, this was years ago. He's passed away, but he was...
But he started on piano?
No, he was a guitar player, but would do arrangements on piano. He would use piano as an arranging tool.
Yeah.
And he did string arrangements and stuff, but he would voice it like guitar chords. Like the way you play on guitar, the way you're voicing... It's not the way a piano player voices. So when he's laying out the string parts, he pretty much, like, he looks at what he's playing with his 10 fingers, and he'll basically voice it like that. The guitar player does a lot of inversion stuff, which gives you an interesting sound.
Well, there's this, you know, tight thing in pieces of chords, right? You know, so he does that. You know, instead of playing a whole, you know.
Yeah. Whereas a keyboard player would play the whole thing more.
Well, you learn, actually, when you start studying, you take the guitar approach and you play what they call rootless voicings. You do it in a way that the audience follows you. And they know where the root, the way you phrase it.
Yeah.
The other thing is you do have to lighten up your touch on piano if you're going to play anything with pianistic. You got to make the piano sound good. That's what my teacher, Terry Trotter, who I just, you know, studied with for 2 years, last couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and transformed everything. But the point is you get different feelings from the instrument. I think that's the point is guitar is such a vocal instrument. And you can take this thing, I'm with, you know, working with Coco Montoya now.
Mm-hmm.
And Coco, you know, like, you know. You hit it hard, and you know. And that.
A lot of dynamics.
You know, and it's when you try that stuff on piano, it's different. You have to find stuff that makes the piano sound good to play. But that my approach was, I think it helped me get a lot of tours, was I played really aggressive, like that guy, the Motown session guy, that Van Dyke Parks? No. That's the arranger. There was a guy named Van Dyke, and he was known for breaking pianos in the snake pit.
Wow!
Yeah, he just played really hard. It, you know, gospel. You know, you in order to be heard with these unmiked pianos, you know.
Oh yeah,
and
those Steinways had heavy action. They are not easy.
I prided myself on the fact that I just really would bear down. And John Cleary, who's a killer piano player, used to tell me, "Man, you know you." Play like you know you really bear down. I like that. And Billy Vera told me one time, you play like a man. I thought it was great, but you know, you can play like a man and then you can play too much like a man. It's good to play like a woman a little bit.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I want to tell me a little bit about this guitar and the Strat that you have and this pedal board.
Okay, so this is this antiquated thing that nobody would ever use in a million years except me, because I just happened to have it, and I felt like not getting the newer versions of this. The Boss, they have something called a G80 or something 80.
Yeah, that's and the ME8. Like, that's an old one.
Yeah, it's insanely old. And, you know, the thing that I noticed about just me is that my tone comes from my fingers, and I saw pictures that I sent you. I was looking at that, and I really tuck it in to my core, you know. So I'm always exerting pressure. So the resonant aspects of the guitar are, and I could be full of you know what, but I think when you incorporate it really contoured into your body, you get a different than you do if you...
Well, yeah, the position is more,
right.
you have more control.
Well, we're, you know, we've got, you know, resonant cavities in our, so I found that I didn't, you know, it's like, why spend another $600 when it's probably not going to sound all that different than this, but we'll see. So this thing has a couple of cool, here, let's turn off the reverb on this. We don't need that. I think there's reverb.
Yeah, it's on this farther down.
Farther down?
The other way, to the right.
A contour, bass, treble,
next
level.
Next one. Reverb.
There it is. That's level. Treble, contour, bass, volume. I don't hear reverb.
No, it's...
Is it this button?
Wait, no, there's a reverb. I can't see it.
Neither can I. Oh, wait a minute. That is reverb. Oh, level. Okay.
You scared me there. I was losing my mind. There you go. You're playing with fingers.
Well, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Yeah, so that's the right? So it's got this great...
this a lot live when you do play guitar?
Yeah, I use it for everything. I, you know, I mean, I admittedly, I used it with Kebmo, and then I ended up with this big pedal board, and everybody kept looking at me like, I think I like that other thing better. And I had like 500 or 600 pedals on this board, and then there'd be like little cables that, you know, wouldn't work sometimes. And what ended up happening is I finished the tour, and then I ended up going back to this because, you know, there's no connectors.
Right.
And as loony as that sounds, the security that you get by not having to worry about...
Now, while you're tuning that, what's the... This guitar is an Elite?
It's a Fender Japanese Stratocaster called an L-Series Strat, and they were really well made. My friend Michael Thompson is a great studio guitar player. Turn me on to it.
It sounds nice.
And I put some DiMarzios in here. They're a little spike in the ear, but they're homeless, you know.
Because I'm going to have to... I want to play a piece before we go out. The acoustic guitar, that's a Larrivee?
Yeah, it's a Larrivee. At the time, the California director, my old buddy from my first record deal band, Larry Lingle, hooked me up with it. And
now, is that rosewood back and sides? I can't tell what it is.
That's
a spruce top, but I mean, I don't know what the wood's interesting because it has a nice tone. It's very bright.
Yeah. Well, you know, they get better with age. So when I first got it, it sounded a little bit plasticky, but it really,
Yeah,
it's a great sounding guitar.
Out of town. I told you it'd go by really fast.
I knew it was going to go by really fast.
It just flipped by, and I didn't even get to play a lot of the clips. But I'm going to let you decide. I have an outro, the last part of If from 2011, If I Knew Then, or I have a clip from the tribute for Requiem for Stevie Ray.
Jeez, I knew you were going to... I would say a what was the one you said?
Requiem for Stevie Ray, or If I Knew Then,
If I Knew Then. That's really okay. And I have to say I wrote this with Tommy Castro, who's a great blues guitar from the Bay Area, and he's got natural songwriting ability, but you know the genre he's in, that, you know, blues cruisy kind of thinking, and this is out of his comfort zone, but he really and again the words are really important, but he always told me I'm never going to be able to perform it because it's about my ex-wife and my new girlfriend will get mad.
Yeah.
So Tommy, I'm sorry I busted that, but it's
well, listen, I want to thank you for coming on, and obviously you just have to come back. We have more to talk about, so we definitely have to. We have to have you back on the show. I'd love to have you back.
But Jeff, you got to stop me at a certain point and say, "Okay, well, put a pin in it, Jeff. Let me ask you another question."
What you were saying about the influences was important. I think that most people didn't realize that what was going on at that time. I was more influenced by like the Beach Boys and the Ventures instead of the blues, and then I went to the Beatles, and I got the blues later with Cream and Led Zeppelin and stuff like that. You got it in a different sequence, which, I mean, I think you better appreciate what was going on in the later 60s because
I'm just on the move. And even this new stuff, all the EDM stuff, there's some incredible stuff. Skrillex, I mean,
yeah.
I have this funny feeling about like cross-pollinating blues with some of these like newer Jamaican beats and using some of this Chainsmokers kind of thing, but with blue, kind of like Moby did with,
right?
You know, and I just, I mean, I you know.
Well, it's okay because we have a lot more to talk about. I tell everybody I can't do it in one show. It's got to be like five or
but
six.
But I'm just the worst candidate.
For no, you're good. You're good. I mean, good stories. No, that was really, you know, that was because there was a lot of stuff happening at that time, and a lot of people don't realize that. Because it influenced so much of what happened in the 60s. So people look at the Beatles, but don't understand what happened before, which led up to it, which is just as important. If I'm correct, your site is www.jeffparis.net.
Yeah, and it's...
You got some interesting stuff there, and you can hear some of the other stuff that he did. We'll, the next time he comes in, we'll play some more clips, too. But I want to thank you again for coming down. It was really a pleasure to have you on here.
Jeffrey, and thank you for putting it up with me.
Oh, it's, it's, and you definitely have to come back. Okay, so this is If I Knew Then, and you're using the Strat, right?
The Strat,
yeah. And what amp are you using?
I think I played through...
Because it's a different sound than what we were playing before.
I think I played through a Super.
Oh, cool.
Silverface Super, and I used this thing, this pedal board. This is what I'm using.
Oh, okay, so the pedal board's being used. Yeah. Everybody, take a listen to this. We will see you next week. Thank you so much, and thank you again, Jeff. Take a listen to this. This is very cool.
Thanks.
I still love you.